You're listening to ListCast. If you'd like to reach us, you can email us at listcast5@gmail.com, or you can alternatively reach us at our website, post comments, or give suggestions for top five lists at listcast.podomatic.com. Enjoy the show.
Okay, welcome to ListCast, and I'm Josh, and Justin is back with me. Say hello, Justin.
Say hello, Justin. I'm back.
Yes, he's back. Our topic today is something we've been putting off for a while. The last one we did together, I think, was the Star Wars episode where we did
things we liked
from the prequel trilogy.
Right.
So we're going to do an all Star Trek one today, and it's
gonna... Star Trek.
Sure. It's going to be top five things we liked from the odd number Trek films, because
the odd number Trek films are generally, for some weird reason, regarded as being inferior to the even number Trek movies. So, In other words, they're saying that Star Trek II, Star Trek IV, Star Trek VI, at least for the original series cast, are better, far better in quality than 1, 3, and 5.
Exactly. And
that's not entirely untrue, but that's a story for another day. Nevertheless, we are trying to defend in some way.
I wouldn't say just defend. People seem to forget about the odd number because they have this curse put
stigma.
On them.
They have a stigma attached.
They do. They have a curse put on them and people avoid them.
I know. It's like each one of them kind of has its own thing. Mm-hmm. Star Trek 1 is the slow one. Mm-hmm. Star Trek 5 is shit.
Is the Shatner.
Is the Shatner one. And 3 is just kind of forgotten. Okay. I don't even really hear that.
Well, let's go through the titles. Okay. Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Star Trek 1.
Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock. Star Trek 5, The Final Frontier. Star Trek Generations. And then Star Trek Insurrection. Those are the five odd number Trek films. We're excluding the new Trek film, which came out in 2001.
Right. Because while I enjoy that, you know, speaking for myself, we're not considering it part of the Star Trek.
Well, no, it started a whole new continuity.
Exactly.
So it doesn't really belong.
It's Star
in this
Trek,
list.
But it's a different.
Technically,
Star Trek.
It's the 11th film, but we're not going to include it.
Right, right. Okay. That movie stands on its own. So.
All right, well, let's just kick it off.
Right,
you were number five, Justin.
Okay. This is tricky because a couple of my mentions here are not single film specific, they kind of apply to a number of the films. So my number five here is...
Wait a minute. You're going to go broad with more than one movie?
You'll see what I mean.
Okay.
Now, some of this applies to, as far as this number five here, some of this applies to all six of the first Star Trek, six Star Trek movies. Growth, development, character development. I don't have a single word to apply to this.
Uh-huh.
But, for example, Star Trek 1 begins... You really feel the sense of time, that time has progressed and they've moved on. Kirk's an admiral. Scotty is like running the shipyards.
They dealt not just with their age,
but with the progression of time.
They didn't just say it's been a year since the show ended, but we all look 10 years old.
Right.
Not only did they
do that, but they allowed the characters to separate, which was kind of a... even though they bring them together very quickly, no one wants to think of their favorite characters, their family splitting up. You know, the Next Generation movies were totally different. Of course, they happened right after the series ended. Nothing changed. You know, that was part of the flaw of the Next Gen movies, the good ones and the bad ones. It never ended. So you never, the characters and the actors never had a chance.
Well, that was accidental as well.
It's just how it
happened.
Accidental's not, it's just how it worked.
Sure.
The original series cast had the benefit of, like, 10 years.
So is this choice just solely looking at Star Trek the Motion Picture? Or are you just...
Well, I think it largely applies to Star Trek the Motion Picture. It's the one, of course, that started it all. It allowed them to be different. It allowed... for a 10-year difference in time for Leonard Nimoy to make Spock slightly different than he was in the show, to allow Kirk to be a little bitter, and to give everyone else their little salt and pepper changes. Now, skipping two, if you want to look at three, same thing's happening in three. Change is happening. Growth is happening. Kirk's son dies. Big, dramatic moments that are not, you know, quote-unquote TV show moments, which are, in my opinion, a lot of what you got in the next-gen movies, even the good ones.
Savick. David.
Admiral, David is dead.
Klingon Bastard, you've killed my son. You Klingon Bastard.
There are two more prisoners, Admiral. Do you want them killed too? Surrender your vessel.
Give me a minute to inform my crew.
I give 2 minutes for you and your gallant crew.
So, you know, you've got Kirk's son's death, the Enterprise being destroyed. Big changes. Things that affect these characters.
Okay, now you're just naming off too many things.
Okay.
Well, we still have a whole show.
I know. What I'm saying, I'm giving examples of this element of change and growth that I think was really good and particularly applied. There was huge sweeping changes in Star Trek 3 because of those things. Sure. And when you get to 5, I wouldn't say there's a lot of growth and change, but it kept the continuity of where these characters were going throughout the series of films. You know, so it's not just a wash. You know, it did have some progress. It kind of tied the knot on the fact that...
Well, they tried to do that with The Next Generation, too.
But
it wasn't successful.
And Kirk said so through dialogue. This is our family. This is who we are. You know, we all may have brothers and sisters out there, but the people right here on this ship, this is our family. And, I don't know, it just kind of tied it all together. They've been through these huge, heavy, dramatic things together. And when it all comes down to it, Spock is his brother. Bones is his brother. And Kirk finally, he probably always knew that, but he said it, and it kind of felt different when he said it out loud. But anyway, like, that's what I meant, where it was kind of a broad, you know, that encompassed all of those even ones. But like you said, Star Trek 1 started it, you know, and gave it that breath.
Okay.
So, sorry for that long-winded.
Well, I got a little more specific with my choices, because there are 5 odd-numbered Trek films, as well as 5 even, of course. Mm-hmm. I decided to pick one thing from each movie.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just talking about the motion picture, so I'll go ahead and do my motion picture choice. And I'm going to go with the spirit of the show, of Star Trek, the motion picture. Now, I recently rewatched all 79 episodes. You loaned them to me, and over the course of like 2 months, mm-hmm. I rewatched all of the original. I was having a great time. Like, every night I would sit down and I'd watch a Trek episode. And it was kind of like watching them for the first time again, because it had been so long.
You really hadn't seen most of them. So.
Some of them I hadn't seen, which I was surprised. So over the course of like 2 months, watched them all. And by the time I got to the last disc, I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. I finally made it. But there's no more after this. I was really kind of sad. I was like, oh, I want there to be more, because I was really having a good time. It's just like, this is a really, really great show.
Right.
So, with that perspective now, I'm able to look at the motion picture in a different light and see that they really did try to capture the spirit of the show, Roddenberry's original vision, into the motion picture, which isn't what people wanted. I'm not saying it was successful, it wasn't, but it is the spirit of the show, and I applaud them at that for trying to project that onto the big screen. You know, they had a great 45-minute script that was 2 hours long, and apparently has been ripped off from the show, which was The Changeling. People like to point out it's a rip off of The Changeling. It's very similar. But the spirit, you know, they still had the triad, the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy thing going on.
Right.
They could have just fucked it up from the get-go, but they decided to take that spirit that was 10 years old. It had been 10 years that the show was canceled, and bring it forward to the new Voyages. And it didn't really work out, but I give them credit for trying.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty. No, I'm not, Spock. Captain Bones. Spock, what should you have known? What should you have known? Comprehension. No meaning, no hope. Jim, no answers. It's asking questions.
What questions?
Is this all that I am? Is there nothing more?
You don't seem to...
No, I agree entirely. In fact, that is, in different wording, essentially my number four.
Okay.
Although I extend it to 1, 3, and 5.
All right.
And there's reasons why it really kind of applies to those odd number ones. I certainly agree. If the original series movies, the original series cast movies, as opposed to the Next Gen movies, had a huge difference, it was that the original series movies... really, even on the films that missed, definitely tried to continue the characterizations that the original series had. The original series was obviously all about Kirk, Spock, and Bones. Of course, Sulu had a moment in there, Chekhov had moments in there, Scotty was probably the stronger of all the support cast.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was always about the triad, like you said. Star Trek 1 was all about that triad.
But you see what I mean? It's not just about that triad. It was about the spirit of the show.
Right, exactly.
The kind of stories that they were telling.
Well, of course.
You get into Star Trek 2, and they knew that...
Star Trek 2 is a whole other animal.
The motion picture wasn't successful because the story was boring. And they go to 2, which is completely a revenge story. And they're sort of like, okay, we need to interject some action. Here's some personal stake. When 1 was all about the growth of man. And
Star Trek 1 is probably the most like the original series.
Mm-hmm.
It's deceptive because, like you said, it's a 45-minute show that was stretched out into 2 hours. If you cut out that extra hour and 15 minutes of fluff and actually edit the show together,
it'd be
a really fucking good show. You know, and no one would think it was boring. It's just because it was so bookended with all this boring, you know, visual stuff. But, like you said, the spirit was there.
Yeah, I mean, if it didn't have the whole, you know, dry dock sequence and the... Yeah. Wormhole sequence. Mm-hmm. All that's just filler.
It is.
For special effects.
That's it. Exactly. A filler. If you took the filler out, it's not boring. But if it's much shorter, it's not a movie anymore.
Well, even then, the scenes alone, when they're actually going into the plot, move at a very leisurely pace. It's not trying to excite you.
They're not worrying about...
Look at this.
We got 2 minutes until the commercials do.
It's like, oh, look at this great story. It's about how we've created a machine, and the machine is sentient now, and it's looking for this great... Look, isn't this interesting?
Yeah.
Well... Really?
Yeah, but like you said, it goes in a completely different direction when Star Trek 2 comes out, and it goes into this revenge action territory, which is totally awesome, and it's great. Mm-hmm. But when you get to... I don't want to say that the triad isn't forgotten in Star Trek 2. It's certainly about, you know, the three of them are largely featured. But Star Trek 2 is definitely more about Kirk. When you get to 3... I really feel like, even though Spock's not there, I really feel the triad in existence, because this is about Kirk and McCoy, definitely. And Spock is there, even though you don't see him. Not Leonard Nimoy, anyway. And then the same for 5. When you get to 5 is very much like an original series episode, where it's about the three guys with your sub-characters in there doing their thing, but it's about these three guys overcoming a problem. Great stuff. Star Trek VI, I love. But that felt more like an ensemble. And even then, it broke up Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Which was fine, but... So anyway, your four. Number four.
I just went.
No, but then I was talking about my four. My four is...
That was your number four?
Yeah. I was agreeing with you.
I thought you had like a replacement four or something like that.
No, I was just continuing on.
Okay. Well, you got to let me know these things because I'm not sure where you're going. Okay. Now, these aren't in any particular order. Like I said, I just chose one from each movie. So I'm going to get this...
So this is your four.
Yes. I'm going to get this out of the way because it's... There's so many things we can talk about with it. From Star Trek III, I'm just going to say the score.
Bastard.
Star Trek 3 is criminally underrated. Everybody, every Star Trek fan should know that. I could do a list of cool things from Star Trek 3 and be up all night. Sure. There's so much good stuff in it. I'm just going to go with the score.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah, I'm just going to go with the score. And since we're talking about it, you know, let's just name off the other great things. The Enterprise blows up. The destruction sequence. Mm-hmm. The actual code sequence. Which was, I didn't know until I rewatched the series, was actually in the original series.
Was it Let That Be Your Last Battlefield or something like that?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
With the people with the half black, half white.
Yeah, it was near the end.
Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. That was it.
Yeah, it was near the end of the,
right.
the series.
Computer. This is Admiral James T. Kirk. Request security access. Computer. Destruct sequence 1. Code 1. 1A.
Computer. Commander Montgomery Scott, Chief Engineering Officer. Destruct sequence 2. Code 1. 1A. 2B.
Computer, this is Commander Pavel Chekov, Acting Science Officer. Destruct sequence 3. Code 1B. 2B. 3.
Destruct sequence completed and engaged. Awaiting final code for 1 minute countdown.
Code 0. 0. 0. Destruct. 0.
Destruct sequence is activated.
The Enterprise escape sequence, the death of David, introduction to the bird of prey, but the score.
Krug. I like Krug.
Yeah, Krug is all right. He's, you know, he's a
little two-dimensional, but, definitely. But he's a badass.
Oh, sure. Anyway, the score. There's a lot of great musical cues in all of the Star Trek films. Mm-hmm. The opening sequence of Star Trek VI, of course, is very good. Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot from the Next Generation films, although they're all right.
They have moments.
They have some moments. Star Trek 2 has some great cues. Star Trek 4 is the... Well, it's got a different composer.
It's the least Star Trek-y sounding.
Yeah. Well, they had a different feel for that movie.
They did.
So.
Well, they brought it to Earth, so they didn't want to sound like space battles. Maybe.
But Star Trek 3, I believe, has the best overall score. It has a very dark, kind of ominous, brooding... kind of tone. A lot of great cues with the Bird of Prey and Escaping Genesis. Just every piece of music in it is excellent. It's been so, I think, beloved over the years that they've recently released the extended edition of the album because people were like, hey, where are these other cues?
Right.
Where are these other tracks of music? I want this. This is excellent. It's like the Return of the Jedi tracks that people couldn't find.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Where's that scene when they fight? You know, I want that piece of music. So the music kept this movie alive. Of course, the movie's brilliant anyway, I think.
Right.
But the score, definitely. I mean, anything else you'd like to say about the score?
Yeah, I'll get to that when I get to my number one. So.
Okay.
Anyway, so are you done with that? I'll move on to my three.
Sure. I mean, there's not a whole lot I can say.
Well, I have more to add to it.
I think it's just an excellent score. Best of, I think, the entire series.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting statement. Okay, my number three is this one pertains just to one of the movies, and this is to Star Trek 1. While 2, 3, and 4, which are kind of regarded as a trilogy, you know, certainly feel, you know, epic, Star Trek 1 has a distinctly different feel than all of the other
visual
styles, visual tone, all of that. It feels different. Star Trek 1 was made in the 70s. The other Trek movies were made 80s and 90s. I think that's when they stopped.
Star Trek 6 was the only one made in the 90s.
Really?
Yeah. 5 came out in 89.
Well, how about that then? But nevertheless, a 70s sci-fi movie has a different feel than 80s sci-fi.
Well, it has a definite visual.
Not just the film stock. It's fucking everything. It's film stock. It's the way music's recorded. It's just different. And Star Trek 1 has that really cool cinematic sci-fi feel to it. You know, of course, it's the first time we saw the new Enterprise. So they really kind of, through cinematography, gave you different looks at the hallways. You know, you get to look around when Kirk first gets on the ship. He doesn't just dock over in the torpedo tubes the way he did in Star Trek 2. He comes in at the back-ass end of it. And he ends up walking along, and you finally see what's in the big second... where engineering is, the secondary hull. You know, you actually see what's in the bulk of that thing. It's, a lot of it is empty space and storage and things like that. Remember that shot?
Yeah.
He walks in and he asks the guy, hey, where's the nearest elevator or something like that? And goes, oh, it's right over here, dumb shit. And he looks out and he looks down into the body of the ship, and you see just off to the right, you see the doors to the shuttle bay, and then you see just this huge open area with one or two ships kind of floating around inside the Enterprise.
I think I know what you're talking
about. And it was a quick, kind of cool shot, but, you know, you got to really see how big the ship was. And this was, it just felt like a cinematic moment. This is something you were not going to see on the show. And everything from, like I said, the cinematography, literally the way people were positioned, and the length of it, the breadth that it took, it felt like a real movie. Star Trek 2 and 3 and 4, those are movies, but this is just different. It just feels bigger. You know? It's hard to explain. I can't quite find the word. I don't want to say it's epic.
I understand what you're getting at. I understand what you're getting at. It's kind of like talking about, say, movies that were shot in that CinemaScope style.
Yeah.
Like Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. Like CinemaScope.
Big feels screen. Like
that. Even though the aspect ratio is the same as the other ones.
Yeah.
It just feels bigger.
It's like, look how big this movie is and how small these little people are.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of thing. It really gave you a sense of that. It's beautiful. Beautiful to look at. But it's not just look. It's kind of the tone and feel as well. So anyway, that's my number three.
All right. Let's see. I've done the motion picture and I've done the Search for Spock. So I'm going to go to... Well, let's just wrap up the original series. I'll do Star Trek V.
All right. That'll be my number two.
I've got three choices. I'm going to go with Cybok.
Bastard! That is my number two.
Sorry. Do you want me to talk about something else?
Well, fine, if you want to. I don't have any backup, so if you want to switch it, go ahead.
That's okay. You can talk about Cybok.
All right.
I'll talk about the pain sequence.
Oh, you're going to actually shoot at a specific scene. Okay.
Well, this is just a backup. Originally, it was going to be Cybok.
All right.
But I'll go with...
I didn't know we were going to go that specific with scenes.
Well, our guidelines were kind of vague.
Okay, all right.
But the sequence, in the end, if you're not familiar with The Final Frontier, which is Star Trek V, which I'm sure a lot of people aren't because it's not a great movie. It's not bad. But
continue.
Anyway, I just feel like I have to defend it in every breath.
You don't need to defend it.
Yeah, in the end, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are confronting the villain, who isn't really a villain, Cybok, which is Spock's half-brother, and he wants to expose their pain telepathically using his whatever, because it will, whatever, heal them. And there's a sequence where they show Bones experiencing a past pain with his father dying, and Spock confronting his past of when he was being born and his father being disappointed that he was so human.
Right.
And of course Kirk is valiantly says, you can't take my pain, I need my pain. My pain makes me who I am. Something in that regard.
Oh yeah, yeah. Give up your pain and give up who you are.
Very good. Yeah, it's a great scene.
It is.
And fortunately it's kind of in this movie, but it is a pretty good scene.
It is a very good scene.
It really gives Leonard Nimoy, and especially DeForest Kelly, to really shine. And DeForest Kelly's used as kind of this crotchety old man character who's like, damn it, Jim, you know, then he gets to be all mm-hmm. sad and heartbroken for about 5 minutes, and it's really kind of touching.
What is this power you have to control the minds of my crew?
I don't control minds. I free them.
How?
By making you face your pain and draw strength from it. Once that's done, fear cannot stop you.
Sounds like brainwashing to me.
Your pain is the deepest of all. I can feel it. Can't you?
Some kind of trick.
Leonard.
Father? Oh my God, don't do this to me.
Leonard.
You know, what's this dad, you know, on the bed? Leonard. Leonard.
Well, yeah, for those that don't know, Cyborg has basically reached into their minds and found probably one of the most painful elements that has built up their personalities and is allowing them to confront it. Mm-hmm. And to a certain degree.
And he has done this to the other crew members, right. But we don't see it. They always cut away.
Right. And it certainly seems that in doing so, according to the movie, it somehow ingratiates them to Cyborg in a way that they're willing to follow him. It's kind of weird. They don't really explain that too much. But in any case, like,
which said, I don't, which is part of the story that really bothers me.
Kind of important. We really should know why some of the Enterprise crew has turned.
Yes, on I know because Kirk. It's, you know, they show him approaching Chekov or Sulu and Uhura.
Yeah,
and you know that he's going to meld with them and take away their pain.
Yeah, you hear the heartbeat.
Yeah, starting. And take away their pain, and then they cut, and then the next scene they're like on board with Cyborg.
Yeah.
And Sulu's like, Chekov, you have to listen to this man. He's brilliant. He's taking away my pain.
Yeah, that's
I'm turning against
deal.
My captain now.
Yeah.
And originally Shatner wanted, or I think Shatner, or the script originally said that Spock and McCoy were going to turn against Kirk.
Hmm.
But
and then the actor said no. They
said wouldn't. No, they would never do that. Right. And why would the other crew members do that either?
Well, because I don't think they're really given a voice at the writer's table.
They wouldn't. It's just...
They probably wouldn't either. They've served with Kirk
I think
just
they
as
would
long
say,
as everybody else.
Thanks for taking away my pain, but he's my captain.
Exactly.
I just met you.
These
Sorry.
Are people that are willing to die for Kirk, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it is a stretch. And I'm not opposed to them doing that to those characters, but they really needed to give the audience a little more depth as to why that was happening psychologically within them. Well,
you were going to talk about Cyborg.
Cyborg, really.
This is your number two?
This is my number two.
Okay.
Specifically, obviously, from Star Trek V. Cyborg.
Well, who's the actor who plays Cyborg?
Lawrence Luckenbill. I think is how you say his name. I think the character of Cyborg, the movie aside, was a fascinating character. And particularly when you look at the pain scene that you just talked about, I think that scene and another one is an excellent example of just how charismatic this guy was. Because, you know, we go in there as fans and we're watching Kirk, Spock, and McCoy together, and really, as evident in the show and in a lot of the other Star Trek movies, it is nearly impossible to craft an interesting villain just in that movie that holds your attention over the crew, because we know and love the crew, and really that's what we want to see. But he was really dynamic and interesting, and in that pain scene in particular, he held his own. He was right up there with the original crew, and I felt like he belonged there with them. And when he is trying to convert them, I believe, as a character, he's fully capable of doing it. I feel the threat in him, and also how people can kind of fall for him, because he has that quality where you kind of just want to follow him because he's so dynamic and interesting. And even the scene when he kind of overthrows Kirk's attempt to stop him on the planet and, you know, rush in on him then, you know, and he stops it, and they're all confronted outside of the shuttle, and Kirk's like, you staged all of this just to get your hands on my ship, and he's like, ha, 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 ha. Yeah. And I'm and he's playing around with the crowd behind him, you know, he's this emotional Vulcan and everything. It was really interesting.
You are under arrest for 17 violations of the Neutral Zone Treaty.
Spock! You've developed a sense of humor after all.
It was not my intention to amuse you. These are serious charges. However, if you surrender now...
I'm sorry, Spock. I can't surrender now. I'm not through violating Neutral Zone Treaty. In fact, I'm just getting started. And for my next violation, I intend to steal something. Something very big! I must have your starship.
You staged all this to get your hands on my ship?
Who are you?
James T. Kirk, captain of the Enterprise.
But I thought Captain Chekov. I see. Very clever, Captain. Spock, it would appear that you've been given a second chance to join me. What do you say?
I am a Starfleet officer.
Of course. Of course.
And I'll take the ship without your help.
I liked his character. Yeah. Like, he was my choice, mm-hmm. my first choice. But in terms of the story, when you look at, say, Star Trek II or Star Trek III, they have a clear-cut villain.
Yeah.
And Cybok is not a bad guy.
Yeah, that is true.
He has good intentions.
He has to do
bad things in order to achieve it.
Right.
Which is the only thing he needs to do, which is to get a starship. Right. Other than that, all he wants to do is help people. And go meet God in the center of the galaxy.
Which a lot of people want to do. Yeah, it's just some of the methods he chose to go about were not the best.
Which is like, well, you're like, I can't really root against this guy because he's not really bad.
But I kind of like that, too. That
well, it's his moral ambiguity. And
just like by the time they finally get to, what the fuck do they call it?
Planet Shakari.
At that point, they don't even consider him a villain anymore.
No.
They're kind of on the adventure with him. Because they want to know, too. He's sucked them right on in. He's kind of done what he intended to do. And so he really did have his victory in that sense. So he got exactly what he wanted. He was a little disappointed with what he got, but he did exactly what he set out to do.
The god of Shakari would not do this. Shakari. That's like, I can't help but quote him. I'm sorry. I've been holding back all this time. This is not the god of Shakari.
Or any other god.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You? Do you doubt me?
I doubt any god
who inflicts pain for his own pleasure. You don't ask the Almighty for his ID.
Just asking a question.
We're going to have to cut that out.
All right. Anyway, so that was my two, so we're on to your two.
Okay. Now, you've noticed I've used all the original
movies
for the odd number ones, so... I'm going to go with Star Trek Generations here.
Before you say anything here, as you'll see when we get to my number one, I didn't talk about the Next Generation movies at all. I really, really tried. I couldn't find any. Especially Insurrection.
I really
picked my mind. I was like, you know what? This is the worst Trek movie ever. I'm going to find something good in here. And I really couldn't come away with anything.
Well, because of my criteria, I decided to pick one thing from each movie.
Okay.
And I, just like you, I'm like, God, what is there that's good in Generations or Insurrection? There's not a whole lot, especially Insurrection.
Slim pickings, man.
But I came up with a few things.
All right.
So I'm going to talk about the Enterprise B and the fact that Kirk, well, he doesn't die. He should have died saving the B.
Right.
Cool sequence. Not a really great one, but it's the only cool part, I guess, of Generations. There's not a whole lot going on in that movie. It's kind of...
So you're saying the only cool part of Star Trek is, Generations is the part that has nothing to do with the Next Generation cast?
Pretty much the first, like, opening
like
20
minutes.
20 minutes. With Alan Ruck is the captain, and...
with Captain Cameron.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it, but Captain Cameron. Cameron Fry is the captain
Captain
there.
Fry.
But even then, the movie is you know, a two-star movie. It's average. It's better than Insurrection, but...
Yeah.
The movie, you can feel, felt really rushed together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And even though the first sequence is the best part, even that feels rushed together.
It does. Something about it. Like,
yeah.
It looks like they literally just threw those sets together.
It's like, oh, we got this leftover set from Star Trek VI. Let's throw that in there. We have these leftover uniforms. It doesn't even matter if they fit correctly. Let's
the uniforms didn't look like they fit quite right.
It's
everything
just
looked off.
Thrown together. It just didn't really feel right.
Yeah.
But the B was exciting to see.
Yeah.
Because we're such freaking Star Trek nerds, we'd read the technical manual and the Star Trek continuity books, so we knew that the Star Trek, the Enterprise B was Excelsior class.
Right.
We already knew that going in. So we're like, oh, cool, we finally get to see the B. Wow, this is a big moment. This is the next Enterprise.
Right.
How does the UP back on the Enterprise bridge? Can I ask you a few questions?
Did you
purchase
credit?
We'd like to know how you feel
Excuse me. There will be plenty of time for questions later. I'm Captain John Harriman, and I'd like to welcome you all aboard.
It's our pleasure.
I just want you to know how excited we all are to have a group of living legends with us on our maiden voyage. I remember reading about your missions when I was in grade school.
Oh, really? Well, may we have a look around?
Please.
Yes, sir. Very nice to finally meet you.
Demora!
Excuse me, Captain. This is the first Starship Enterprise in 30 years without James T. Kirk in command. How do you feel about that, sir?
Oh, just fine. I'm glad to be here to send her on her way.
And what have you been doing since you retired?
Keeping busy.
You know, they never really show it on an adventure, but maybe that would have made a cool show. Anyway, but seeing the Bee, seeing the next in succession, and then, of course, Kirk... being Kirk,
right.
Dying as he should, dying alone, and heroic.
Well, not only that, but saving the ship.
But yeah, heroic.
Yeah,
not falling off of a catwalk or whatever. What was
falling
that?
Falling off of a bridge.
Yeah, that was, you know,
to decloak something. That's it.
Yeah, it was stupid. This is, you know, they wanted to bridge the two generations. I guess that's a nice concept on paper.
Well, even all the people behind it realized they fucked up. They all admitted it.
It was just. Not a very good story.
Right.
It was just an excuse to bring Captain Kirk and Captain Picard together.
Right.
And it was...
Everyone wanted that. They just didn't like the way they went about it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, what's your...
All right. My number one is essentially what you already talked about, only I'm going to extend it to the other three.
Okay.
That is the music.
Okay.
In my opinion, Star Trek One, the soundtrack, is... the best Star Trek movie soundtrack.
Really?
Yeah. I love the soundtracks to 2 and 3.
The motion picture soundtrack.
Have you really listened to that?
Yes.
It is a beautiful score.
It's what's that? Like, synthesized? Or what,
no,
what
it's fully orchestral. What are you talking about?
No, it's got that, like, boom, boom.
That wasn't a synthesizer. That was a special instrument.
But it has a...
It's got a really...
It's got
cool
some 70s style in it.
Maybe that's part of the reason I like it.
You
but
like
course,
that over the Trek 3 score? I find
I
that...
I say I like it more. I think they're kind of apples and oranges.
Okay.
It's... I mean, we're talking about Goldsmith versus Horner here. Totally different.
I appreciate that Star Trek, the motion picture... reorchestrated the theme.
Oh, hell yeah.
And gave us the theme.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's think
I
about
like that.
He came up with this brand new theme that obviously spanned the rest of Star Trek. And then the dry dock sequence, all these different character moments. It's a great, beautiful score. Part of what lends itself to what was my number three, which is kind of the epic reel. This is a big movie feel. Felt like a big CinemaScope movie. But likewise, on there is the soundtrack from Star Trek III, which is highly underrated because the movie's underrated. But it's a great score.
It's kind
which,
of, yeah.
As I understand it, James Horner wasn't overly thrilled with because he was kind of rushed.
With 3?
Yeah.
Oh, I disagree.
No.
Well, I mean, with him.
I've read this, that he, when he did two, he had kind of all the time he needed and whatever. But when he got to three, of course, they loved the work he did in two, so they brought him back for three. But for one reason or another, the production schedule, whatever, was shorter. I read that he did not have the time that he wanted, so he felt kind of cheated in a way. He still delivered a fantastic score. A lot of motifs, a lot of themes and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I just read that he was unhappy with the fact that he felt so rushed. And as a result, he did not come back to Star Trek. That's what I read. I don't know how true
that is. That's too bad.
Well, yeah, which is really a shame because he certainly changed the sound of Star Trek and, you know, created an awesome sound for mm-hmm. it. But coming full circle right around to Jerry Goldsmith in Star Trek V, it's a great score. Also underrated because the movie is kind of shit on all the time.
You know, see, I don't think about the music cues when I think about Star Trek.
Exactly, you don't, because they're buried under action or whatever, but go back and listen to the soundtrack. They're really good scores.
Well, you know, I think it must have been, like, I felt it was just bland. Like, it was just kind of there. And there was nothing special about it. That's why I never think about the music.
I think that's because the movie feels that way. But if you listen to the soundtrack separately, particularly the opening sequence with Kirk climbing the mountain, that take the visuals out. It's great
music. Well, I can hear the music in my head when it comes to the opening sequence. I remember that.
Now, I tried to extend this out to Generations and Insurrection.
You couldn't come up with anything?
Generations had cues that were good.
I'm not talking about the music, but you couldn't come up with anything from Generations
really
or Insurrection?
I had a really hard time, man. Obviously, Insurrection I thought was a total loss.
But you couldn't find anything. Like, I found it's really broad, but...
In Generations? So.
I mean, you must not have racked your brain hard enough.
I spent most of my time thinking about Insurrection because I was like, there's
that's the fun of it. Like, coming up, like, what is it's like the prequel trilogy. Like, what the hell can we find that's good in it?
The thing that I like the most about Generations is that because they were using the Enterprise D sets right from the show that ended 5 minutes ago, they had to change it in some way to make it feel cinematic as opposed to a 4:3 aspect ratio.
This was one of my backups for Generations.
This was the cinematography.
Yes.
Particularly, of course, the lighting. Mm-hmm. You know, when they go into 10 forward, they're being lit by the star that's out there.
Or his ready room. He's being lit by the sun.
It's dark. Exactly. Yeah. It's ominous. When they get on the bridge, it's not stage lighting. It's internal ship lighting. Mm-hmm. Little dark, you know, but still it feels like a movie lit thing, which was kind of cool. But they had to go kind of way overboard because we just saw the show 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. And they knew that they had to really kind of be different while still using exactly the same sets.
Okay.
But anyway, that's the one thing I can say I liked about Generations was the look and feel given the sets that they were on.
Okay.
But yeah, the music for 1, 3, and 5 I thought were really good. And I think the music for 1 is generally regarded as being excellent. The soundtracks for 3 and 5, however, are lumped into those movies suck category, so people don't even think about it. You know, when people think of 2, kind of the music, you know, you know, people know that. Trek fans know that, and it sticks out. So,
okay. Anyway.
So what's your 1? You got me hanging on.
Well, like I said, there's only one movie left.
Insurrection?
Insurrection.
Fuck, give me. I'm dying to know what your
thing is. Well, since you didn't pick anything from Insurrection, I'm just going to name off everything I picked from Insurrection.
Please do.
Okay. I'm going to name them off, and then I'll talk about them. The injection of humor. Picard gets a Woody. And they commit treason.
Suck.
Okay, now I'm not saying any of these were successful. I'm talking about the ideas behind them. Now, injection of humor, which was the goal.
Awful.
Would you let me finish?
Sorry.
Which was the goal of Star Trek IV. We just had this really dark movie, this really dark trilogy. Let's lighten things up a little bit and inject some humor, have some fun. They were successful. They tried to do this in Insurrection by inserting some humor.
It is a gorge,
Captain Pepple. Yeah.
Mr. Worf, did the hostages mention anything about a cloaked ship during their debriefing?
No, sir.
Debrief them again. Have you been in a fight, Mr. Worf?
No, sir. It is a gorge.
A gorge?
Pebbles.
Oh, well, it's hardly noticeable.
Yeah, Worf getting his zit. Riker getting shaved in the bathtub. Some other things. But they tried to lighten things up a little bit. And
was the joystick scene supposed to be a joke? Was
that funny? Oh, the joystick?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm going to inject this thing to turn left.
Because when that thing popped up, I started laughing.
Yeah,
and did. I don't think it was supposed to be funny. Because he has a very serious face.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
Computer deploy manual steering column.
Yeah, that was just embarrassing.
So I can turn the ship to the left.
Yeah. So I appreciate them for trying to do that.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
You got a minute?
Sure.
I need a little counseling.
Well, it's the first time for everything.
So do I lie down or what?
Well, whatever makes you comfortable. But this isn't one of the usual therapeutic postures.
But it is comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you try sitting up?
Why don't you try lying down?
Well, you're in quite a mood today. Do you really need counseling, or did you come down here to play?
I think I'm having a midlife crisis.
I believe you.
I'm not sleeping well.
Dr. Crusher has something that can take care of that.
What I need, I can't get from Dr. Crusher. Counselor, do you think it's possible for two people to go back in time, fix a mistake they've made?
On this ship, anything's possible. Yuck!
Yuck!
I never kissed you with a beard before.
I kiss you and you say yuck?
And Picard gets a Woody.
Literally?
A British tar is a soaring sword. That was a funny scene. That was their attempt at humor.
What?
That whole scene when he's trying to break through to Data.
Trying to be funny. It wasn't
funny. That
was
ridiculously unfunny.
Yeah, they were trying to be funny. They weren't.
Yeah.
Picard gets a crush. He meets a woman who isn't interesting at all. None of the characters are interesting. But the fact that they treat Picard as a man. You know, he's a man. He's going to find women attractive.
Right.
Now, I'm using this as a caveat to talk about two other things. An episode from TNG called Lessons.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that in Star Trek First Contact, I think originally it was played that he and Lily were going to have a thing.
Right.
But it never came about. Because when I originally watched that, I kind of felt a subtext.
Like
they were supposed to have a thing. So the fact that they allowed him to, in the instruction, to fall in love or to have a crush or an attraction, I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting because he is just a man and he does do these things. And in Lessons, which is a pretty good episode from TNG, he unexpectedly develops an attraction for a woman that's...
Stellar cartography.
Yeah, it's just the right type for him.
Yeah.
And it's... I wish they
were... Brainy and strong and all that.
Yeah. Forthright, as Crusher would say. And... perfect fit for him. I wish they would have played up that a little bit more.
Right.
Maybe brought the character back or something.
And Nell, I think her name
Nella.
Was.
Nella Darren.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She left the ship, though.
Because couldn't be together.
Because they boned.
Because they boned.
Yeah.
Well, they never actually showed them having sex, but it's implied that they did.
Dude, he shagged her right in the friggin'...
Well, they showed them kissing.
In the bowels of the ship. You know what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was that scene, you know, when they start to play the music and then Data and Geordi are like, do you hear that?
Yeah, sure.
And they start going over and start peeping in.
Yeah, I know.
And then the music stops. You know why it stopped? Because they were rumping and the bumping.
They were kissing. They didn't show.
Yeah, that's what we saw. But shortly after, they were bumping uglies right there in the conduits, man.
And it's never something I thought of.
And then Picard, when of course they left... can we call maintenance down to Jeffrey's Tube 38 Section B? What's there? We have a spill.
Should have said, you know, housekeeping.
Housekeeping!
Yeah. So the fact that in Insurrection, that they allowed him to...
To get a boner, as you
put. To get a boner, to find a woman attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, and my other choice was the choice of letting them commit treason, which is something that harkens back to Star Trek 3, where they do... Where it's... They go against... Starfleet for personal reasons.
Right.
For something they believe
is right. Unfortunately, in 3, it feels organic and it feels correct. When they do it in Insurrection, it's like...
Well, these are my reasons exactly. It isn't successful.
Yeah.
In Star Trek 3, the personal stakes are very high, so you believe and follow them on their choice. When it comes to this, in Insurrection, where they have to save the...
Baku.
The Baku, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Save the Baku because Starfleet wants to move them.
it feels like their motivations are just written mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. Whereas in 3, you're just like, fuck yeah, they've got to do this. This is what's got to be done.
Well, you know, they have to save their friend. This is a very personal thing to them. And this is just, well...
They're like, well, if Picard's doing it, I guess we can do it. Okay, we'll go.
It's just like, okay, well, this is morally wrong, I guess.
I'll go.
Shit.
I won't let you move them, Admiral. I will take this to the Federation Council.
I'm acting on orders from the Federation Council.
How can there be an order to abandon the Prime Directive?
Prime Directive doesn't apply. These people are not indigenous to this planet. They were never meant to be immortal. We'll simply be restoring them to their natural evolution.
Who the hell are we to determine the next course of evolution for this people?
Jean-Luc, there are 600 people down there. We'll be able to use the regenerative properties of this radiation to help billions. The Sona have developed a procedure to collect the metaphasic particles from the planet's rings.
A planet in Federation space.
That's right. We have the planet, they have the technology. A technology we can't duplicate. You know what that makes us? Partners.
Our partners are nothing more than petty thugs.
On Earth, petroleum once turned petty thugs into world leaders. Warp drive transformed a bunch of Romulan thugs into an empire. We can handle the Sona. I'm not worried about that.
Someone probably said the same thing about the Romulans a century ago.
With metaphasics, lifespans will be doubled. An entire new medical science will evolve. I understand your chief engineer has the use of his eyes for the first time in his life. Would you take that away from him?
There are metaphasic particles all over the Briar Patch. Why does it have to be this one planet?
It's the concentration in the rings that makes the whole damn thing work. Don't ask me to explain it. I only know they inject something into the rings that starts a thermolytic reaction. When it's over, the planet will be uninhabitable for generations.
Admiral, delay the procedure. Let my people look at the technology.
Our best scientific minds already have. We can't find any other way to do this.
Then the Sona can establish a separate colony on the planet until we do.
It would take 10 years of normal exposure to begin to reverse their condition. Some of them won't survive that long. Besides, they don't want to live in the middle of the Briar Patch. Who would?
The Baku. We are betraying the principles upon which the Federation was founded. It's an attack upon its very soul. And it will destroy the Baku. Just as cultures have been destroyed in every other forced relocation throughout history.
Jean-Luc, we're only moving 600 people.
How many people does it take, Admiral, before it becomes wrong? 1,000? 50,000? 1,000,000? How many people does it take, Admiral?
I'm ordering you to the Gorin system. I'm also ordering the release of the Sona officers. File whatever protests you wish to, Captain. By the time you do, this will all be done.
Like, this is morally wrong. They're moving these people. They shouldn't be moved. This is kind of like the Indians or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Like, anybody cared. Don't even get me into the plot of that movie.
Well, the plot is...
No, it's fucking ridiculous because the evil admiral is 100% fucking right.
I know. The plot is ridiculous.
Now, F. Murray Abraham's character... utterly useless.
Yeah.
But the Admiral was dead fucking on when he told Picard, what right do these fucking people have who are not indigenous to this planet
to use it
and be like, fuck you can't have it. Now, granted, the Baku never said, everybody stay away. They probably would have welcomed anybody. They were very nice people. But the Admiral had a plan to convert this ship that could save billions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the faults they have with that movie is that they never quite explain, like, why maybe didn't the Admiral just go down there and say, hey guys, we're going to take the shit out of the atmosphere. Are you cool with that? You're welcome to stay. Like, well, you can't be here when we do it. We'll take the shit out. We'll put you back. You're going to get older, though. You know, but we'll give you a shot to this stuff if you want. you know, perfectly fucking reasonable. Mm-hmm. And if these people have been using this juice for a while, they really need to suck it up and move on. But yeah, that's a huge plot of the movie. Plot hole.
Well, yeah, the story was... It wasn't a good movie. It's just not. It's ridiculous.
It was an excuse for Picard to have these motivational speeches.
In our opinion, it is the least successful of all of the Star Trek films, and our least watched. It is incredibly boring. It's completely bland and boring. There's nothing interesting going on.
The music is boring. Everything about it is boring.
Yeah. The kids playing hacky sack and the kid with the worm. And it's like, I can see a decent 45-minute Star Trek Next Generation episode in there.
Yeah, sure, it would have been just perfectly fine episodes.
Yeah, just not feeling this movie, I'm sorry. But those elements in there that they tried to put in there that didn't work, I'm like, well, I can appreciate you for trying, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
So that's my number one.
All right. Well, I guess that pretty much wraps us up
with
our attempts to convince people that the odd movies have some salvations in them.
Sure.
More so the original series movies than the next gen ones.
Well, I actually took the attempt to try to find
I tried, man. I tried. I didn't think mentioning the cinematography in Generations was worthy of my top five.
It's something.
Well, I would rather talk about these other things.
Okay.
And I see no one talked about Nemesis. Or
That's number 10.
That's right, my bad. Generations, I mean, really? Generations? Come on. Whatever. Nothing.
All right. Well, I'm Josh. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Justin.
Thank you.